that mean it's the last episode?
I know, it's a bit mad.
It's been crazy. We've been working on this for how long?
I know.
So, we are in our final episode, which is episode 6, and we're going to discuss something that's incredibly on everyone's mind in the industry.
Yeah, I think that, without a doubt, our industry is constantly talking about this. It's in a lot of our works, it's in a lot of plays that I go and see, and it's such an interesting subject to discuss in a podcast where you've got such intelligent people bringing so much depth to it.
I know, I can't wait to start this. So should we just go ahead and say the title of the final episode of Tell Them Series 2 is The War on Woke and Cancel Culture.
Shout out.
Yeah, and we have some amazing guests with us today. But before we go into that, if you haven't already, please check out last week's episode where the brilliant Yasmin Abdul-Majid spoke to Alia Al-Zoghbi and Elias Suhail on all things Muslim and the media, reviewing the book entitled On Islam, Muslim and the Media, edited by Hilary E. Khan and Rosemary Pennington, on the basis of the conversation. The book is available online and costs around £15.
So coming back to today's episode, I'm really eager to get going. So I think it's about time to introduce our guest presenter, who is joining remotely from Berlin, Charmaine. Hi, Charmaine.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, very hot, but staying hydrated.
Good. Drink lots of coconut water. That's amazing for hydration. Charmaine Lovegrove is the Managing Director of Dialogue Books, a brand new division of Hachette UK with the remit of inclusion, inspiration and innovation. The publishing division is a home for a variety of stories from illuminating voices, often missing from the mainstream.
Charmaine was a recipient of the Future Book Publishing Person of the Year 2018-19 and is inspired by innovative storytelling. She was the literary editor for Elle and set up her own bookshop and creative agency when living in Berlin.
Charmaine serves on the boards of the Black Cultural Archives, The Watershed and bookshop.org.uk and is a founding organiser of the Black Writers Guild. Home is London, she lives in Berlin and her roots are Jamaican. Charmaine is proud to be part of the African diaspora and books make her feel part of the world. What a bio, what an absolute powerhouse. How amazing to have you here.
Wow, I've been very busy.
Yeah, you have. Well, I mean, I think listeners are, you know, they've heard enough of me, so I'm going to throw the mic over to you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a joy and pleasure and an honour to work with Tamasha. I love the work that you're all doing and it's so important and it's great to be part of this podcast. I'm really happy today to be joined by Chino and Mel. So I'm going to hand over to them first of all to introduce themselves. And Chino, do you want to take it away?
Hi, yeah. Well, I'm Chino. My writing name is Chinonyama Dimba. I'm a playwright and poet and director and also artistic director of Theatre for Honsey, which is a British African heritage theatre company. I've been writing and working in the theatre industry for about 20 years now and kind of very, very passionate about the idea of grassroots. I know it's an old term, but it feels really important and how that relates to words like radical, which I think is somewhere in this conversation as well. But I'll hand over to Melz to introduce himself.
Amazing, thank you. My name's Melz. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Cambridge, exploring questions of the production and creation of knowledge outside of kind of Eurocentric ways that we're taught to produce knowledge. I'm also the founder and director of an organisation called the Free Black University, which is exploring radical education outside of the institution. Aside from that, I'm a speaker, I sometimes write poetry, and I'm just a human trying to live a full and expansive life. I'm also an advocate for LGBT community, specifically the trans community, as well as, just trying to live life.
Listen, I mean, this is the thing, is that both of you are absolutely incredible, inspirational people and just gives me so much joy. And I think that's something that's really important in our Blackness as we go into quite a big topic, is to kind of acknowledge that that joy that we can also bring to our radical work. So first of all, I'm going to get straight into it. I would like to get each of you to give me a description of, you know, what the word woke means to you. I'm going to start with you, Mels.
Okay, so the first time I came across woke was probably when it was a really good word. And that's probably around the kind of 2013, 2014 times where I feel like so many young people, young Black people across the world were being radicalized, especially through platforms like specifically Facebook. And we had like lots of different Facebook groups talking about decolonizing university, talking about like police brutality, talking about a number of different kind of topics regarding racism and regarding liberation. I saw woke emerge in those spaces as a way to kind of define our collective awakening. And so it was this kind of dichotomy between we were once asleep to the ills of the world and the racism and the harms that were happening. Specifically for me, it was the decolonial movement, like Roads Must Fall from South Africa, and how that kind of spanned across the world. And so around that time, woke was a term that we collectively used to kind of describe what was happening to us in that process. But as time went on, woke was a word that became very co-opted by, I guess, people like, you know, the Piers Morgans of the world to kind of talk down to a group of people that were kind of expounding what some may call like left-wing or anti-racist kind of rhetoric. But even within that, the kind of language of woke, we kind of moved away from that, because it's less so a dichotomy of being awake and then being asleep. It's a process of ever becoming. So now the word woke to me isn't necessarily a word that I resonate with or a word that I use, but it is this kind of snapshot in history of like this time where I experienced a collective awakening.
That's so interesting. I really remember that 2013 moment, which kind of came from the riots that happened in 2012 in the UK after the murder of Mark Duggan, and how literally the sort of streets of London being ablaze kind of felt like there was literally an awakening. And it was really amazing to see how that spurred like the next generation of Black people to literally take hold of what is ours and what the future could be and what it looks like when we're not just sort of subjugated to kind of to whiteness, but where our places in, especially in a colonialized system and of oppression. And so, yeah, it's really interesting to kind of go back to those roots from 2013. Chino, what does the word woke mean to you?
I guess for me, the word, you know, as Mel's just said, was once something that felt like it was speaking to that idea of a reawakening. But in some ways, I think that the reason why I don't want to talk about it in the sense of sleep and waking is because I think for me, the word initially was about a sense of empowerment where people were demanding not only their own self-growth, but that people actually start to do the work to grow in their knowledge of all the things that were affecting our lives as Black people. I very, very quickly fell out of love with the word. I think partly because even before it became a product in which to beat people with, I found that it was very limiting for me to use it, because it did speak to something that I was finding really difficult, which is that if we say that we've all been asleep, then what that means is that we all have to be implicit in that sense of being asleep. And I felt like some people weren't seeing themselves as needing to learn as well. And so in a way, it did become a word that was speaking to other people and not to ourselves. And the way I tend to view the world, in whatever sense, whatever we're talking about, is that I've been implicit in what has been happening, whether that's around disability or sexuality or gender politics. I've also been like implicit in how those systems have worked. And so it just started to feel like it was always speaking to something outside of the self. And that's when I stopped using it. But like you, Mels, I haven't used the word for a very long time.
It's really interesting because I think that one of the first times that I heard the word woke was always sort of more around an American sort of 80s African-American cultural perspective. So kind of Spike Lee and like Do the Right Thing, kind of seeing wokeness as being part of that, or sort of a later part of blaxploitation. So I never really saw it as something that we would use in Britain. So it's interesting that you both acknowledge the sort of the short life of it in a way, from a positive perspective. What's probably had like a longer lifeline then is phrases like the war on woke and cancel culture. What do these terms evoke in you now when you hear war on woke, when you hear cancel culture, when you know that you're going to come on this podcast and talk about it? Nels, I'm going to go back to you.
And just before I respond to that, I just kind of want to mention as well what Chino's answer made me think as well about how woke almost makes it seem like the work has been done. And so when you're talking about still being implicit in those systems, it was kind of it was this idea of moral superiority, when, because yeah, it's a very final, like, okay, I was asleep, now I'm awake, or however you may phrase it. And none of us are awake. Like I was saying before, it's that ever becoming. And so I think that's really important to kind of like, I think there was a moment that we all did become somewhat humbled in like how much we just did not know. And then allowing that word woke to kind of be pushed to the side a bit. But when it comes to cancel culture, war on woke, like, as soon as cancel culture became a thing and like Twitter was starting to just cancel different people that had done like horrible things, like for me, it just personally never resonated. Like, I just didn't understand why we should cancel anybody. And I think it's in part like my personal view of the world, because I believe that all humans are like inherently good. I believe that we're all born like a little child. It's born perfect. Do you get me? And so it's the world, it's the systems that make people do awful things. And I guess thinking about like my own life and people that I've had in my life and the things that they have done, and then thinking, oh, so the whole world would cancel you, but like you're still like my dad, or you're still this person that's important to me, even though you've done incredibly harmful things throughout life. And so I never believed that people should be cancelled. However, like, when now the right has this language of the war on woke and making it seem like there's this brigade of morally superior people that are trying to cancel everybody, it's difficult, because there's so much more in terms of the breadth of people that are doing radical work, that are doing work to assist in trying to transform this world. And to just focus on this war on woke, it kind of takes so much attention away from the people that are doing like really radical work. And I guess as well, it's so anti-abolitionist as well for me. And I do consider myself somewhat quite an abolitionist, in a sense that I believe that the world can be completely different to how it is today, and we don't need things like prisons and police, etc. And to say that anybody should be cancelled is completely like juxtaposing that. And so there are this massive group of radical people that also equally don't believe in cancel culture, and equally don't believe that there is any person that is morally superior to another.
You know, the ideas around cancel culture and war on woke are the opposite of being radical. And so we're going to come to that a bit later on, because I think that that's a really kind of interesting point in terms of those juxtapositions. But Chin, I'm going to go to you now and ask you, you know, what do those phrases, war on woke and cancel culture, what do they evoke in you when you hear them?
I think for me, the first reaction or the first reflection is always around power. What we're talking about is power. It's just we don't like to use the word power a lot of the time in our day to day. But I think cancel culture is kind of multifaceted, because It's about those who had power who are now afraid of losing that power, but it's also about people who know and are becoming more and more aware of the power and the agency that they own to change things. And so whichever way you look at it, it's kind of it's power plays that we're talking about. And I don't think that when you're talking about power plays, it's ever as simple as just one way or the other. However, I do think that what it does sadly do in a lot of ways is that it takes the things that I'm most passionate about away from us. It takes conversation away from us. It creates binaries where there needs to be nuance, and more importantly, I think, as you've just said, Mels, it's like, how do we, as human beings, we have to be able to learn from each other, and it's sometimes our lack of capacity to go beyond ourselves or to show our vulnerabilities that creates this sense of there being, you know, a cancel culture, because on either side, you know, it's like vulnerability and power are the two words that I probably reflect on every single day. And for me, those two words really sit in this conversation. I mean, the war on woke is such a bizarre idea in of itself that it feels like it's almost pointless talking about it, if I'm totally honest, in the sense of, like, you know, cancel culture feels like something that is people are grappling with. The war on woke has always felt to me like some very, very small-minded people trying to hold on to some weird kind of power that they think that they have, or that the world that they should have.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, there's a regression against those of us who are progressive. There's a regression from the conservative, not just the party, but conservative and traditional society. And, you know, I'm always really interested in what people see so threatening about the idea of other people being awoken to an idea of, whether it be around who they are themselves or what we can all be capable of in terms of a progressive society, and also just having a sort of understanding of history. For example, you know, seeing the Conservative Party try and completely shut down the National Trust, which is a very conservative institution. It's in England. Seeing them shutting down the research that they're doing into enslaved peoples and the money that was then given to landed gentry, for example, because they consider that too woke. And then you think, what exactly are you afraid of the truth? And I think that that's the thing that really scares me when I see this war on woke, and when I see this cancel culture, is that not as someone who believes in conspiracy theories at all, but someone who absolutely believes in the truth of atrocities that have happened in this world. Knowing the truth is the only way for us to progress. And by not being able to look backwards, then I'm not sure how we could move forwards. And so what is it that you think that conservative and traditional society are really afraid of?
I mean, it's sort of an old-fashioned phrase, I guess, and I'm sort of an old-fashioned person, but, you know, the idea that the political is personal, we should never ever forget. The idea that in order for something, for you to fully embrace something on a political level, and to engage with it on a political level, you also have to engage with it on a personal level, and you also have to engage with it in a bodily way. And that's what I think people are afraid of. You know, it's what Mels was saying. Sometimes we're living, even in our own families, with voices and opinions that are difficult for us, but we can't just throw those people away. So we find ways to navigate that. And sometimes that personal stuff is what I think people are really afraid of. And I think we've forgotten that the political is personal. We've forgotten that when someone is afraid of how we address, you know, about pronouns or whatever it is. It's like going, what is it personally that this is doing for you? Where are you feeling it in your body? I'm not like a big hippie, but I do want us to look at stuff from a completely holistic point of view. We're walking, breathing creatures, and that means that when something impacts us, it doesn't just impact our minds, it impacts us physically and emotionally. And so that personal embodiment of the thing is, I feel like that's the fear at the heart of this. So you go, well, if I have to use pronouns now, what does that mean? Does that mean that I have to excavate how I feel about my body? Does that mean that I have to excavate those weird emotions that I might have had sexually? Does that mean that I have to go into places myself that I've firmly put a lid on? I just feel like, I guess that's where I always sit with this, is like the personal and the political are so beautifully and kind of wholly entwined that it's impossible for us not to talk about the fears that sit within us as people and individuals. I don't know what you think, Mel.
I couldn't agree more with everything that you've just said. I guess it made me think a lot about the word shame, and like you brought up vulnerability earlier, and in everything you just said as well about people having to like look within themselves when somebody does stand up and say, these are my pronouns, or I'm trans, or I'm queer, or this is what I believe I deserve in life. Like, then you realize, oh, I have rejected so much my whole life. I don't want to open that. So I'm just going to try and shut you down. Like, I think that's such a beautiful way of expressing it. And I just really think that we need better ways to deal with shame and to like be able to work with these feelings and emotions that all of us have that are just so human, but it's so much easier to just shut them down because we are shameful of our shame, and it just leads us into a place where we try to have a society that is so like limited, because it means that we don't have to go past kind of emotional frequencies that we're not comfortable like exploring beyond.
I love that we've already got into Aristotle there, you know, in terms of going backwards to bring it forwards, and all of these ideas around sort of shame and vulnerability. Really, the reason that we're sharing how we feel, who we are, where we come from, is so that we can, well, for me, it's so that we can get to a place of understanding, so we can get to a place of equality and equity, and so that we can all live freely. And the idea that that's not something that is shared, especially by our governments, and especially, you know, by people at the highest echelons of education, etc., is actually quite distressing to kind of, you know, live through that. So for me, there's a real fear around what that means to have conservative society, traditional society, really kind of shut down any kind of questioning in terms of a change of mindset or a change of values. And then that leads to more shame, more vulnerability, and then that displaces more people. Okay, so we've had some really interesting ideas around shame, vulnerability, around progress, around the idea of kind of a collective thinking. And now I want to think about the two pieces that we have for discussion today. So there was a brilliant new play by Zadwa Naoni, and that was directed by Nancy Medina, called The Darkest Part of the Night, which is on at the Kiln until the 15th of August. And also an insightful commentary on YouTube on The Problem of Cancel Culture by Aisha Akabani. The Darkest Part of the Night is a lens on a family's experience in Leeds in the 1980s, and how later as adults, two of the family's siblings struggle to find common ground as they see their shared past differently. A past that is clouded by racial discrimination, police brutality and poverty, and also the struggle for survival. And in order to move forward in their lives, the siblings, they need to understand each other, and they really need to respect their differences. So firstly, for me, one of the things that's so striking about the play is the importance of nuance and intersections. And as Black people and people of colour, the play to me rightly highlights how we have to endure stigma for being who we are, but also how we see and accept those in our families, wider communities and culture. What are your thoughts on this?
One of the things that really struck me about the play was, again, this idea of shame. And so when the young girl had like left the door open, and then it had kind of gone into this series of events where her brother had been locked up in the Maudsley mental asylum, and her dad went to prison. And it took, I'm giving so many spoilers. And it took up until her mum passed away for her to open up about what she had actually done. It just like demonstrates that we live in this society where even to the people that we're closest to at times, there's so much shame and fear of being punished, that we hold in some of the most important things to share, or we allow other people to take the rap for it. But it's the fact that we live in a society of punishment. Like, I don't believe in punishment, but I come from an African household, so I was brought up on punishment. But that punishment is just the kind of, it's like the microcosm of like the state. And we live in a state that is so heavily policed that when people do things that are wrong against the state, even if they don't harm other people, they then get pushed into prisons, and then they're profited off, and that's what we are taught to believe is what keeps us safe. And so, yeah, it just made me think a lot about how even in our most intimate relationships, there can be so much fear of being punished and being wrong that we hold so much in. And as well, like when you hold something in, it will rot inside of you. And I think they might have even said that in the play to some extent, but it will rot inside of you. And what impact is that having on you and your body? And coming back to what Chino was saying, that this embodiment, like we're not taught in this world to think through our bodies or to experience life through our bodies. We're told that our intellect is the only important thing, but there's always something happening on a bodily level, on a spiritual level. And for us to hold so much in, or for us to not be true to ourselves due to fear of punishment, is only going to harm ourselves and everyone around us.
That's so interesting. And I think, you know, there's a lot to unpack with that, of what you've just said, Mels. Thank you so much. I think one of the things that feels kind of quite clear in listening to you and Chino speak this afternoon is these sort of ideas around sort of the stigmas, especially as Black people, and that actually for us, it's really imperative that whatever woke means, in terms of if it means enlightenment, if it means engagement, if it means further understanding, that these things are sort of played out within the public sphere so that they make a difference within the private sphere. And I think that sometimes there's a misunderstanding that it's just about wanting to pull down statues or wanting to make huge changes, structural changes within our society. And sometimes it's, although those are things that we want to do, actually the safety, being safe at home and being able to say, this is who I am without fear of reprisal, and that kind of you can't be what you can't see, that kind of mantra, like the more that people are able to be open about who they are, then the more it has an effect on our lives as individuals. And so it's, you know, for example, being in Jamaica with my grandma and my best friend who is a gay man came out to see us, and my grandma was really upset that his boyfriend didn't come. I can't imagine that like 30 years ago that my grandma would be asking someone where their boyfriend is and why they couldn't join them, asking a gay man that. But we've moved so far, and that means a lot, and that's in a private sphere. And every time there's someone who's able to do that of that generation, then that will make a difference to how gay people are seen, queer people are seen, trans people are seen in a country that where it's illegal. And these are the things that make a difference. And that's why we really need these kinds of plays. We really need people to be awakened to modern life and us as individuals. Chinos, what's your thoughts specifically on sort of the stigma of Blackness and how that sort of pertains to this play?
I mean, I loved the play and felt really emotional after watching it, because I think there were lots of things in it. I think firstly, where it was set is sometimes, you know, we've talked a little bit here about history. And I think one of the really interesting things is that if you grew up as a young black boy or man in this country in the 1980s and early 90s, you know, the choices in terms of either being criminalized or sectioned were very clear. And I have three brothers, and I felt like those were the choices as a family we were constantly trying to make, how to keep them out of a police station and out of a mental institution, because either of those things felt like a real possibility. And I think we shouldn't forget that the ideas of representation that we have now, or that you can see a black QC, or you can see a black politician, however corrupted and disrupted their souls are, those things did not exist in those times. And so for me, what the play brought into really sharp focus was how clear and how easily those were the things sometimes that we were being pulled into, especially young black boys and young men. And it was sad to be reminded of those times, but it was a good reminder for me that, you know, we as a community have to be aware that within those family spaces, we're navigating so much all of the time. And when you send your child out of that front door, you're sending them into a world that is impossible for you to imagine sometimes. And I thought the play captured that beautifully. And one of the things that we mustn't forget is really the question of neurodivergence, because we rarely talk about that in, certainly in black communities and certainly within black families, about how neurodivergent young people are also much more likely to be criminalized or abused or killed, as it was recently the case. And we just can't lose that. So just going back to where we started with this conversation, how am I meant to not have a conversation about the policing in this country when innocent young and black men who are simply having a mental health episode are so frightened by the police, tasered by the police, that they jump off a bridge into the water and they die in 2022. That does need to be cancelled, my friend. That needs to be cancelled. So for me, the play just reminded me of how high the stakes are for us sometimes in terms of understanding, yeah, what those choices are, what those choices have been since the 80s, what they continue to be. And I was incredibly, incredibly moved by it as a piece of theatre. Yeah.
That's so interesting. And I think it's really important to kind of note the difference in between the 80s to now, and the difference of the outcomes of the lives of young black people, and especially men, especially those who are neurodivergent. It just is something that wasn't understood at all. And is still something that I think we're struggling with within our communities. One thing that was really striking about watching the director and writer in conversation was the fact that as black people, with all of our nuances and intersection, really understood that there's never a point in which we can leave that behind. We can never escape that sort of the label of wokeness. Do we always have a responsibility towards it? I want to underline this sort of idea around responsibility, because the play is really about these siblings that are trying to find their way And as someone who's estranged from members of my family, then I found it really interesting, this idea of needing to have that understanding, that familial understanding and care and love in order to move forward. So, you know, that idea of responsibility is something that sort of really I'm thinking about a lot, because I suppose my thinking is like, if we don't look after each other, then society is not looking after us. And so who will be there?
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's actually something I've been thinking about a lot recently. And I feel like for a long time, my kind of view has been that I have a responsibility to my community, and that has underlined everything that I've done over the past 10 plus years of my life. But then I realized I also have a responsibility to myself. And then I'm like, how do I now negotiate and navigate this? Because the person that sometimes holds so much responsibility, who has a responsibility towards them as well? But I think it's something that is one of those things that has to be an ever constant negotiation between having those responsibilities to ourselves, and also where are we giving from? Where are we holding responsibility towards our community from? Is it from a space of abundance? Is it from a space of lack? Is it from a space of fear? And being able to hold those responsibilities with as much care as possible, but also know when it's time to hand over the responsibility and be in an ecosystem that's strong enough to hold multiple people in that role.
And Chino, what are your thoughts around sort of responsibility and sort of the question of wokeness, and do we always have to carry it? Can you be an intersectional Black person and not carry this burden of wokeness?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I have about four different hats that I wear on a daily basis. I'm an artist, and as an artist and storyteller, I have absolutely no responsibility or commitment to anything other than my own imagination. And I say that really clearly, because politically that's important, that Black artists are allowed to just be artists. So I hold that artist self really softly and gently and strongly. Holding a position of leadership in theatre and the arts in the UK, yeah, I have a responsibility. I have a responsibility to those artists who come to my company to make work and to talk about work. And I hold that responsibility really clearly, because in order to hold that responsibility, I need to hold the power as well. So again, there's the word power. So I think that for me, that with that hat on, it feels really clear that responsibility to my community, and that community is the artists and the audiences and the people we on a regular basis engage with. Yeah, I need to understand and be awake to how they are treated in other institutions, and make sure that when they come to work with a company like Teatro Pozzi, they're treated with respect and with care. And that's really important and kind of central to the work we do. But I also have a responsibility as a mother. And, you know, I'm mother of a young woman who's existing in this country and in this world. And there is a responsibility not just to teach her what she needs to know to survive, but to ensure that she sees other Black people in the way they should be seen, not in the way society tries to implant in her, which is really important to say, because I think that there is still, and it goes back to that thing of us all being implicit in this, there is still some work that we need to do with the younger generation to keep finding and decolonizing ourselves. So I have to teach her those things. So do you mean like I sometimes in one day I'm just juggling all these hats? And then, yeah, I guess as a woman with a physical body and sexual desire, I also have to then hold a responsibility in how I put that out in the world, and who has access to my emotional life? So it's a really hard, it's such a big question, because those responsibilities sometimes don't exist for me as an artist. I'll make the work that I want to make because politically that says something. And then in other spaces, that responsibility feels absolutely necessary. And I think understanding that, and I guess that's what comes back to the kind of, I have very little sense of binary in my life. You know, I'm a Gemini. It's all messed up, like from the offset. That's just how it is.
Thank you. That's such an incredible answer, and something that I heavily resonate with, and I'm sure lots of listeners will as well. A bit of a change of gear now. So Energy by stylist and writer Aisha Akabani's critique of cancel culture was really lit. I thought the whole piece on giving people the opportunity to grow and learn from their mistakes was really important to recognise and also to enact. What were your thoughts on the problem with cancel culture, Mals?
Yeah, I thought it was a great piece as well. And similarly, my issue with cancel culture has always been that humans are human. And if anybody thinks that they are like never going to do anything that is cancelable or something that hurts another person, then they're deluded. Do you know what I mean? And so I've always believed that cancel culture, it has no place in our movements, it has no place in our homes, it has no place anywhere. But for so long, I feel like it almost is a way to immobilize people, because I've seen in movements, like I've been a part of various like grassroots movements in the UK, and I've seen how in movements, when like certain words are said or leveled against certain people, it completely immobilizes the movement. It completely immobilizes the people. It re-traumatizes people. It just goes into a whole mess. But we don't have that ability to like support people through their whatever is happening. And so it is this idea that we need to allow people that space to grow. And like, we live in such a culture of kind of critique, and like just like there's so much to say wrong about another person or another thing or whatever it may be, but so little to say about how are we moving forward and how are we growing from this, how are we evolving into something new. And that's what I'm so much more interested in. And I believe that everybody has the capacity for as much good as everybody has a capacity for as much bad. And I always believe that given the worst conditions in the world, I would probably do the worst thing that the worst person has done. Do you know what I mean? Like when you watch them Netflix documentaries and then you go into the things that happened to these people in their life, I'm just like, if we lived in a society that was focused on healing and supporting people that have gone through like incredibly traumatic things and then end up doing incredibly traumatic things to other people, like if we lived in a society that was focused on helping these people heal and offering these people love through their pain, then we may live in a different world.
Oh my gosh. I mean, the idea of living in a different world where we actually would have freedom to be ourselves and also to be our best selves is something that we can only dream of. But that idea of being absolutely realistic about who we are, and that no one is born perfect and nobody can go through life without any faults is something that's just really important and absolutely humbling.
No, definitely. But I do believe that everybody is born perfect, but we can't go through life being perfect. And so if we can always kind of return back to that sense that everybody is inherently good, but the conditions are the things that make people bad, or their ability to understand beyond their conditions and so on are the things that make people like do quote unquote bad things, then I believe that that's what allows us to walk into a different future.
I mean, I'm coming to the end of my parental leave and I've got 11-month-old twins and they are perfect, so I will take that. The visual aid accompanying Aisha's interview on Double Down News of the redemption of Malcolm X and his story from street fighter to civil rights activist served as a powerful reminder of self-growth. What did you think of this, Chino?
I mean, it's... on the whole, I thought that it was a really clear and articulate kind of critique of cancel culture. The problem I still have is what sits at the heart of this sometimes is hypocrisy. So should someone like a much older white male DJ who has been known for as long as I've been at college to go to college balls to DJ in order to sexually assault young black women, should he be cancelled? Yes. Should he be the only one that comes under critique? No. Because there is a whole system that has enabled that behaviour. I mean, he came to my college and he, you know, behaved in exactly the same way. I'm not naming any names, but he behaved in exactly the same way as everyone else has reported he behaved. And because it was young, quite often dark-skinned black women who were saying the things that he was doing, they were not believed. So is there a system at the moment that means that if you are a dark-skinned black woman, you are not believed? And is that the thing that we should be attacking, but or should we just be cancelling him? And this is where it gets, for me, harder to just kind of fall into that. Because I'd go, yeah, that's the truth of it. Sitting here today, I would go, yeah, that man should be cancelled and should never be seen in public again. That's how harsh I can feel it, right? But I also know that there's a system that has people who look like me who have also been implicit in allowing that behaviour to continue. Are we going to have that conversation or no? And that's where I felt that I was needing to push into that piece a little bit more. Of course, we've got to grow. We've got to learn these things. We've got to experience and see the world through other people's eyes. But when it comes to certain things, I'm afraid I go, yeah, that guy, he should be cancelled. And I don't know what I do with that, because that's, you know, other than admit that that's actually how I feel. But also, we've got to look at the system that allowed him to behave like that for the last 35 years and allowed him to co-opt a culture in such a way that people started to believe he was really was investing in the culture. But show me how he's given back to that culture over the last 35 years.
It's so interesting because on one hand, you have cancel culture and the war on woke being used, as you're describing, against something that's sort of criminal activity versus someone having an opinion on something on Twitter. And, you know, it shows the kind of extremities of this sort of debate. It's almost inappropriate to kind of that it's been used in such a the broader sense, because actually there are sort of individual judgments on individual actions, and some people have growth and other people have hidden and have been hidden by communities. And whereas other people have opinions that we don't agree with, but those opinions also cause harms to other individuals. So it's really kind of such a sort of a complex area to dissect. I really feel that, and I really appreciate both of your opinions today. So I want to think about resolutions and how we move forward in the face of cancel culture and anti-wokeness. I was really thinking about something I was reading on Instagram about cancel culture and anti-wokeness and the generosity of us feeling as though it's a them problem. So when somebody is trying to cancel you, when somebody is telling you that your wokeness, you know, what you assert, for me being a publisher, as a black woman, as a queer black woman, my responsibility is to ensure that voices from marginalized and minority communities are heard and upheld and amplified. And so often I get a lot of people telling me that, you know, why am I publishing the books that I publish? And I really have to see it as a them problem. And this is what this Instagram post kind of helped me to understand. It's a them problem, not a me problem. And that also helped to reframe my thinking. So when faced with criticism or anti woke rhetoric. What tools do you both use for self-preservation? And I think, Mels, you alluded to this earlier around the self. Yeah. So do you want to go back to that?
Yeah. For me, it's always coming back into myself and coming back to, like, kind of like my spiritual practice, coming back to like who I know myself to be as a soul. And if I'm moving with integrity, if I'm moving from a place that is like heart-filled and soul-led, then whatever anyone has to say about me, it's none of my business. And that's a lot easier said than done, because obviously I have feelings. I'm a Cancer, innit? So like, I'll be feeling all my feelings.
All the feelings.
Every single one. So that's not to say that it doesn't upset me or hurt me, but it means that when there are those kind of voices or that criticism, because to be honest as well, being in academia, like, I realized each day that anything can be argued, like literally anything, and you can find a million things to back it up, and you can just finesse any argument you want to finesse. And so people are going to have completely different opinions to me, but I have to come back into myself and realize that the world that I'm trying to build, the beliefs that I have as a person are what are guiding me. And so I need to give my contribution to the world and allow them also to give their contribution to the world, even if they are completely disparate.
So what advice would you give to anyone who wants to engage in social justice and its many guises but are afraid of backlash? Like, how do we remain radical and safe? Chino?
This is a really interesting one for me, because very recently I wrote a play called Black Love, and a particular critic who came to see the play obviously took a lot of offence about the fact that my play was focusing on black people loving black people, and particularly the kind of exercise of raising black women to a particular position in terms of how I see them. It always comes down to me to a quote, and it's a Zora Neale Hurston quote, which says, "If you are silent about your pain, they'll kill you and say you enjoyed it." So I have to practice constantly keeping my voice alive, because I feel like that is my way of not ever saying, if you are going to kill me, you're not going to kill me and tell anyone that it was okay by me. And that idea of, you can critique my work, fine, but I also will always have a right to reply as an artist, as a black woman, as someone who just exists in the world. I should always have the right to reply. And that is a really uncomfortable thing for a lot of people, because we're talking about the war on woke and we're talking about cancel culture. But right alongside this is respectability politics. And we have to talk about that. We have to talk about how many people don't express themselves, don't want to be accused of being woke, don't want to really say what they're thinking, because they're so tied to the respectability politics that says, if you're quiet and you behave, you'll get far in life, right? And so that's for me where so much of this stuff sits for me, is I won't be silent. You can't kill me and I'll be silent.
Amen. And can I also add as well that I also see the ways in which not just what the right or people outside social movements may say deterring people from coming into social movements, it's also this cancel culture within social movements that is deterring people from actually wanting to say anything, because there's this idea that if you're going to stand up for what you believe is right, then you have to be perfect. But none of us are perfect, and then we're all holding each other to these ridiculous standards, and then none of the work ever gets done because we're imperfect people trying to build in an imperfect world. There's always going to be complexities that we have to overcome. And so it also reminds me of, I think it's a Malcolm X quote, like, if you stand for nothing, you'll fall for everything. So you just got to stand for what you believe in and then just pray to God that it all works out, innit?
Yeah, I mean, or not pray to God, you don't have God,
which yeah. is also okay.
I even believe in God. But you know, yeah. it's really kind of that Zora Neale Hurston quote is really, really important, which, and you know, and it's it is the thing that we seem to, all three of us seem to just kind of keep going, because that fire is burning, and also the pain is real. The pain is very real. And if we are silent, then it's kind of, you know, silence equals a kind of complicity. And we need to be heard, because we need the stories to be heard. And we need there to be a huge amount of change in order to get to a space that we feel, well, as I said, for me, it's equality and equity. What does the future hold? And what can we learn from great activists in the past? And I'm going to go to you on this one, Mels, especially as your work with the curriculum. I'd really love to hear your thoughts on what we can learn from great activists in the past.
So what does the future hold? And I believe that the world can be so different to how it is today. I believe that literally everything can be transformed. And I think one of the things I always kind of go back to is like my own transition, and this idea that if I have like transformed my own life and like my own body in such a way in like just 28 years of my life, then nothing is fixed. Everything is changeable. Everything is forever in flow. And it's for us, and it's a Octavia Butler quote as well, like, we have to shape change, and she talks about that in Parable of the Sower, that change is inevitable, but it's how we shape that change and whether we believe we're the people that are going to be able to shape that change. So I think it's always incumbent on us to shape that change. And what can we learn from people in the past as well? Like, when I have a bookshelf, and I always kind of go to my bookshelf as not just like a bookshelf, but as an ancestral altar as well, because when I read those words that people like revolutionaries from throughout history have had to say, like, it's also an ancestral practice. They're still with us today, and they're helping us shape these radical movements for transformation.
Radical transformation of not just a self, but society is a really optimistic thing and a really great place for us to end our conversation today, because it's quite a big topic, as we've said, and we don't want to get cancelled. But if we were to think
cancel us, then
if we were to think about radical transformation that leads to equity and equality and leads to space for all people to be ourselves, then I think that that's something that we can hopefully we can all get on board with. Chino, any last words before we hand back the mic to Tamasha Theatre?
No, I mean, it's just been such a fascinating conversation. And I love, you know, I love the idea of the radical transformation. The word radical is sometimes overused, but, you know, it goes back to what I started saying about, you know, and I'm struggling to remember the exact quote, but, you know, it's about grabbing things by the roots. You know, that's what we're all trying to do. And when you do that, you shake up the garden, right? And not everyone's going to like it, because it's going to look ugly and it's going to look really messy for a little while. And I think we're just in the kind of ugly, messy bit of it. But the reluctant optimist in me is still going, but there will be flowers. I'll bring you flowers. That's my end note. But no, seriously, I think, yeah, I'm this conversation helps me to get to that place of optimism, because I think we're in the messy bit, but out of that other side of that, you know, could be something really beautiful.
We can only hope. Thank you both very much for your time today, for your thoughts, for your engagement, and also for your radical activism. You're both making a huge difference to our communities and our societies, and I look forward to working with you on other projects in the future.
I'm going to echo that. Thank you so much. Like, sitting in the room and listening to all three of you converse in this way is just, I don't actually know what to say. I'm actually speechless. And I feel like you've done an incredible job to have those sort of conversations and the nuances in just an hour. I feel like we need to like curate like a weekly episode and extract every sort of like segment that you've spoken about. So thank you so much for joining us today.
No, my pleasure. Like, it's just...
I actually love doing podcasts. Like, I actually didn't realise how much I do.
Come back and do another one. What was that? You want to do another one?
Wow, that was an incredible conversation, and what a conversation to end this amazing series.
We couldn't thank all of our guests enough for coming along and being part of this series, and we hope that everyone listening enjoyed our conversations.
And I hope you really enjoyed mine and Samia's amazing introductions and outros. We spent a really long time planning them.
We are not presenters.
We are totally not, which is why we've curated some amazing people on this. So bringing it back to them, thank you today to Charmaine, Mels and Chino for this incredible hour.
All of the episodes are now available online wherever you get your podcast from to re-listen, listen for the first time, or catch up on the ones you have missed. If you like what you heard, then go on our Twitter page and hashtag tell them and tell us your thoughts.
And of course, follow on our socials and our website, tamasha.org.uk, and see if there's anything else that resonates with you and possibly a next series. I also wanted to just do a massive shout out to the Roundhouse team, in particular Marnie and Tom, who have just been amazing producers on this podcast who you don't get to see or hear. So a massive shout out to them. Thank you so much.
Shout out Marnie and Tom.
Yup. She's in the other room and she's like, we can see the tip of her head, and she's been a wonderful, wonderful person to work with, as you were as well, Tom. Thank you. And that's it.
Thank you and goodbye.
And that's it!